Welcome back. Yesterday I talked about this structure of having a topological field theory, sigma, and a topological boundary, rho, a right boundary, sigma x, on the right, and that whole picture is topological. And I said that that's analogous to having an abstract algebra, and just as we can have modules over an algebra, so too we can have a left boundary theory or a left module over the symmetry structure, and that this whole thing, when we dimensionally reduce, should be isomorphic to some quantum field theory. So the picture is that we have this topological piece, sigma and rho, and that's the abstract kind of symmetry. We have a field theory F on which we want to make the symmetry act, and that data is a left boundary theory F tilde together with an isomorphism when I dimensionally reduce to get back the original theory F. And furthermore, we can consider all manner of defects. We saw some defects yesterday in quantum mechanics, but we could have all sorts of defects, some of them sitting in the topological part of the theory, some of them just sitting on this rho boundary, this regular boundary, and some of them also sitting in the non-topological part. And all of those translate over here into defects in F. And we should think of those as analogous to the elements of an algebra, which act as operators in any module. So in the next two lectures after this, I'll give you some examples of how this setup works in kinds of examples that are occurring in the literature. But for today, I want to talk about three different topics that we need for that. The first one are some general remarks about field theory, mostly about topological field theory. And secondly, I'll talk about a class of topological field theories called finite homotopy theories and give you some examples and indication of how we can compute with them and how they're very computable. And thirdly, then I'll talk about defects, which are the main things here that operate. So let me say some words about field theory. And I've already said it a few words yesterday, and Kentaro said a lot more, so I won't go into a lot of detail. But I said that there are these discrete parameters that specify the type of field theory. The first one being n, which is the dimension. Think of it as the space-time dimension. And secondly, f, which is the specification of the background fields. And now I see that the erasers are missing. Found at least one of them. Okay. Yes, so I told you background field is something like having, for example, a Riemannian metric and a spin structure. So I said I would talk about a mathematical definition of what we mean by a field. If we're going to talk about field theory, we should know what we mean by a field. But I think in the interest of time, I'll actually leave that discussion to the notes and the references. Let me say that a field, what are its main properties? Well, if we fix a dimension n, a field has to be something defined on n manifolds. So to each n manifold, we have to be able to give a collection of fields. So the collection of Riemannian metrics is a set that we assign to any n-dimensional manifold. If we look at the set of G connections or gauge fields, that's not quite a set because that has internal symmetries, and so that's more properly a groupoid or a stack. Now, that has to have the property that the fields pull back. We always have to pull back, change under change of coordinates, for example. And so the kinds of maps under which a field pulls back is a local diffeomorphism of n-dimensional smooth manifolds. And then the characteristic property, which is really the characteristic property of field theory in general, is locality, one of the characteristic properties. And to encode locality, we impose a sheaf-like condition, that if we have a manifold and we cover it by small open sets, we can patch fields in the small open sets, which are compatible in intersections. We can patch them uniquely to a global field. That's a sheaf condition. So those are the kinds of things that go into a formal definition of F. But for the lectures I'll give here, I'll use this kind of notation. And in fact, I won't always make explicit these fields. But one of the exercises I put in the notes for this lecture is I just listed some standard quantum field theories like gauge theory in four dimensions with this or that, and just asked you to find what are the background fields, just to get used to thinking in those terms. Now, if we have background fields, we can also get maps of background fields. So for example, we could take Riemannian metrics together with orientations. And you see there's a map like this. The metric is just the identity there. And a spin structure has an underlying orientation. And so you might imagine if you have a map of fields, and if you had a theory over F, a theory with these parameters, you might hope to produce a theory with the same dimension, but these background fields. In other words, you might hope you could sum over the fibers of this map. So sometimes the fibers have, you know, usual continuous fluctuating fields, like a connection. You'd have to integrate over connections. That's the usual picture in quantum field theory. Here, the fibers are fixing an orientation, spin structures that refine a given orientation. Well, if you're on a compact manifold, that's a finite set. So if you're going to sum like this over this map, that will be a finite sum. And that's the kind of thing that we'll do in the second part of the lecture when I talk about these finite homotopy theories. Okay, so a field theory has a domain and a codomain. It's a map from the domain to the codomain. And these are categories. And the domain is a Bordism category of manifolds of dimension n, you should think possibly with boundaries and corners, and equipped, each manifold is equipped with a background field, with a, say, Riemannian metric and spin structure. So this has the structure of an n category, and we could make that a little fancier, infinity n, whatever. And the basic composition law is gluing together Bordisms, as I think Kentaro explained, but it has another structure, which is categorification of the idea of an abelian group, which is a symmetric monoidal structure. And that symmetric monoidal structure is given by disjoint union. So that's the domain. Now, the codomain well, we have to decide what kind of invariance we're going to give. So if we have a closed n-manifold, we want that, under the theory, to map to a complex number. Why do we want a complex number? Well, ultimately, because in quantum theory, we have interference that's encoded by complex numbers. A closed n minus 1 manifold, that should map to a complex vector space. Again, it's linear because of superposition in quantum mechanics. And what do you want to map an n minus 2 manifold to? Well, here we want to think about factorizing this vector space. See, if we have a closed manifold and we chop it up as a composition of vortisms, then we're taking this number and expressing it in terms of a composition of linear maps. We're factorizing it through vector spaces. So in a similar way, we could imagine taking an n minus 1 manifold, chopping it up, and wanting to factorize this vector space in terms of something. And the kind of thing we might use is a C-linear category, or we might use a complex algebra and factorize it by having modules over an algebra. So there are choices, and even at this stage, there's a choice because we could have put Z2 grading in other words, a super vector space, and that's relevant certainly if we have statistics like bosons and fermions. And if we have those statistics here, well, we're going to get statistics here and even more kinds of statistics. And furthermore, if we're not in a topological field theory, then these vector spaces should have a topology. They would typically be infinite dimensional, the state spaces of a quantum system. So there's lots of kind of variation and choice here. And I think that's something Mike will talk about in the topological case later in his lectures, perhaps. But just for these purposes, we can just let C be the codomain. This is some kind of symmetric monoidal N category. And the symmetric monoidal structure here is tensor product. And all along, there's a notion of tensor product. Okay, so in this language, pardon me? No, they shouldn't be closed.
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, why should all... Why should all the manifolds be closed? And I was just telling you a small piece of this and how we expect that to map. But in fact, we don't have closed manifolds. We might have typically a bortism like this. So if this is a closed, if this is an n-dimensional manifold, we might have an n minus one dimensional manifold here, another one here, where we think of these as incoming and these as outgoing. Can you see the colors? Yeah. And so this in the bortism category would be considered a map from n0 to n1. And when we have the field theory that I'm about to say, we should apply it not just to closed manifolds, but to morphisms. And we can have corners in a more elaborate structure of an N category. Okay, but I'm not going to review all that. I'm just going to say the basic definition is that a field theory is a homomorphism F from that domain to wherever we want it to take its values. So here, by the word homomorphism, I mean a map that preserves all the structure. So in this context, it's called a symmetric monoidal functor. It has to take compositions to compositions, the different N composition laws, if you like, in this N category, and it has to respect this symmetric monoidal structure. It has to take disjoint unions to tensor products. So that's the basic definition. That's the framework in which we can engage with field theories. There are lots of comments to make. I'll refrain from doing most of them. Some of them are in the notes. But one important comment, Well, maybe just for those who aren't familiar with this framework, let's suppose that we have X, which is an M, I guess I'm calling it, which is an n-dimensional manifold. Let's say it's closed. Then if I evaluate the theory, we get a complex number, assuming that my category near the top looks like complex numbers at the top. But supposing in physics, what you want to do is put in what we might call point defects. And we'll see that attached to the point defects, we're going to make certain operators. And one way to think about that is to cut out a little ball around each of these. In a non-topological theory, we'd want to take a limit as the ball shrinks. And so if I cut that out, and I want to look at these boundaries as being incoming, well, each of these boundaries is some sphere. Let's say S1, S2, each of these is topologically a sphere sitting inside the manifold. And what do we get now? We have a Bordism, sort of M hat, is a Bordism from when I cut out these open balls, I get a compact manifold with boundary, and the incoming boundary is the disjoint union of these spheres, and the outgoing boundary is the empty manifold of that dimension. So when I apply the theory, well, I have to remember that disjoint unions go to tensor products, so I get the tensor product of those, and since it's a homomorphism, the unit goes to the unit, the tensor unit. The unit under disjoint union is the empty manifold, and the unit for tensor product is the complex numbers if we're talking about vector spaces. And so we get a multilinear map from vector space at each point. These are the point defects or the point operators into the complex numbers. That's the correlation function.
And there's a couple questions on Zoom.
Yep.
So Vivek asks, for a non-topological field theory in the evaluation on an n-1 manifold, should the n-1 manifold be viewed as a submanifold in a germ of an n-manifold? Is
yes.
This already included in the definition?
Yes. I haven't made that explicit, but yes.
And Shuhung a while back asked, can there be obstructions in summing over spin structures?
No. I mean, if you had a well-defined theory, you could sum. Okay, so correlation functions, if you look in physics texts or physics papers, they're viewed as functions of parameters. The parameters might be, for example, the positions of these points. And those should be smooth functions of those parameters, as long as the points stay distinct. So I just wanted to point that out to say that the way I've said it, there's a very big deficit in this axiom system, which is that this is appropriate for evaluating on a single manifold. But in fact, you want the theory to be able to be evaluated on families of manifolds, smooth families. So a smooth family of manifolds is a fiber bundle in geometry. And so we want to take these Bordisms and allow an arbitrary manifold of parameters and think about fiber bundles over that. So in a sense, we have to sheafify the whole theory over manifolds of parameters. So starting at the beginning, what the notion of a background field is, the Bordism, the codomain, all that needs to be done in families.
Dan, before we continue, I have another question on the chat.
Yeah.
They ask if you could explain the meaning of symmetric for F being a symmetric monoidal functor and why it's needed.
Well, it's the intuition that when you have two quantum mechanical systems, there's an operation of taking their union without interaction. And so that operation is what's being encoded. That means that, for example, if I take the disjoint union of two n-1 manifolds, the state space on that disjoint union is the tensor product of the state spaces individually. And that's what that operation is. Okay. Yeah, quick questions, because I don't want to get too hung up. we're getting the defects in the last part of the lecture if we get there, and I want to get there. Thanks. Okay, so I want to say one more thing about the general field theory, which is product structures. And so let's think of the usual example where n is equal to 2, and let's look at the what we attach to the circle. So here's the circle. And well, we can consider this Bordism, so I'll call it M, I guess. That's a disk with two, a closed disk with two open disks cut out. And I want to think of these here as incoming, this one as outgoing. So in other words, M in the Bordism category is a map from circle, disjoint union circle, to circle. And while we're at it, we can also think of the disk. This is a disk, D2, and we think of this as outgoing. And so this disk is a map from the empty one manifold to the circle. And this is a kind of algebra, you see. If I have a map from something tensor itself into itself, that's, think of that as a product. And this behaves as the unit for that algebra, the identity element for that composition law. And so the statement is that in this case, f of s1 is an algebra in vector spaces, meaning it's a vector space with an algebra structure. And what's more, there's a diffeomorphism of this manifold with boundary that exchanges these two boundaries. We rotate around like that. We can exchange them like that. And if you think about it, that proves that this is actually a commutative algebra. So if we were in three dimensions and we consider the circle in three dimensions is codimension two. In codimension two, you see we're assigning something like a category to it. And this would give us a product law on the category, a monoidal structure. And this commutativity would be what's called a braiding. It wouldn't quite be commutative in the strong sense of being symmetric. So these spheres allow these products, and these products are what we're going to use to fuse defects. All right. So that's all I wanted to say about general properties of field theory. Are there any more questions before I go on? Okay, so let me get to the second topic, which are these finite homotopy types, or finite, what did I call them? Finite homotopy theories. And these are topological theories, so we'll definitely be in the realm of topology. So let me make a formal definition. Let's let X be a topological space. Then we say that X is pi finite if, well, first of all, pi naught of X is finite. So pi naught of X is a set. It's the set of path components of X, and we want there to be a finite number of path components. Then I want that for all choices of base points, the homotopy group of X with that base point is finite. So all the homotopy groups are finite. And also pi q of X, let's say there exists some positive integer q such that pi q vanishes for all q bigger than Q. Okay. So that's pi finite. In short, it has finitely many path components, and each path component has finitely many homotopy groups, each of which is a finite group. And this number Q, if we choose the optimal one, we'll say that that's Q finite. So we're going to look at field theories where background field takes values in one of these spaces, and we'll be summing over those fields. Now, yes, okay. We could also have the definition of a pi finite map. So that's a map between spaces. The spaces needn't be pi finite, but the homotopy fiber of the map should be pi finite. All right, so, well, let me give examples. So the first simplest examples would be if I just have a single homotopy group. So the space is path connected, and then for some integer Q, there's a single non-zero homotopy group. So if Q is equal to 1, that can be a finite group, could be non-abelian. Or if Q is bigger than 1, it has to be an abelian finite group. So I'll try to keep with this notation throughout the lectures that G is always a finite group, A is a finite abelian group. So these building blocks are what are called the Eilenberg-MacLane spaces, and so we can have the space which has the single homotopy group in dimension Q, let's say, and the homotopy group is perhaps G if it's in dimension 1, or A if Q is bigger than 1. So this is a space which I'll use the notation BG, meaning it's the classifying space of the group G. So a map into here classifies principal G bundles. For G finite, a principal G bundle is a covering map. It's a finite covering map, and it's a regular cover or a Galois cover in the theory of covering spaces. This space is also a classifying space for a group. It's the iterated classifying space of A. Or if you like, it's the classifying space of the group B, Q minus 1, A. So this will come up when we talk about field theories which have a symmetry that includes this B, Q minus 1, A. That's what's called a Q minus 1 form symmetry. But there are no forms. There's a group here, and the group is this. So those are the basic building blocks. But just as with ordinary groups, we can have extensions. We can have group extensions. So we can take products, or we can take twisted products, semi-direct products, things like that. And so one extension that comes up a lot is to have B squared A. So again, the words one form asymmetry would be used in physics. When that's appropriate, we would have BG, zero form, if you like, G symmetry, and we have a space X that's an extension like that. So this in topology would be called the Posnikov tower of X. X is a space where pi 1 is isomorphic to G, pi 2 is isomorphic to A. So it fits this definition. It only has two non-zero homotopy groups. It's path connected. But there's more information here that describes this extension. It's the same as in finite groups. There can be an action of G on A, and then there can be a cohomology class that classifies the extension. So this is what you might call the classifying space of a two group. And I won't use this example today in the lectures. I'll use just these simpler examples to illustrate, but I gave you some homework problem, well, problem, not homework problem, to think about how what I'll say about defects works in that case. Okay. So let me just make a comment about spaces and higher group weights. So let's suppose that S, say, is a topological space. Then there are lots of things we extract from S. So the first thing we extract, as I said, is a set, pi naught of S, the set of path components. We put an equivalence relation that two paths are equivalent if there exists a path between them. The next thing we extract is we're going to remember more information. So we're just going to go up a kind of categorical ladder, if you like, by remembering more information at each stage. So at this zeroth stage, we don't remember the points, we just remember whether or not they have a path joining them. At this stage, we're going to remember the points, and we're going to remember the paths between them, but only the paths up to homotopy. You see, at the first stage, we're remembering the points up to homotopy, two points being homotopic if I can connect them by a path. So this is what's called the fundamental groupoid. It's a category in which the objects are the points of the space, and a morphism between points is a path that connects them, but we only know remember the path up to homotopy. So that's called the fundamental groupoid. For example, the self paths at a point x up to homotopy, they make a group, which is called the fundamental group based at x. And this is a groupoid, meaning it's a category in which every morphism is invertible. We can run paths backwards. Well, the next thing we would extract is to remember the paths. But now, remember maps between paths, which are now, if you like, little surfaces or kind of loons, but we remember those only up to homotopy. And so we get a structure that has not just objects and morphisms, but it has one more layer of structure. In other words, a two-category, or in this case, a two-groupoid, and so on. And you can go back and forth between groupoids and spaces. Given a groupoid, we can construct a classifying space that has those homotopy groups and so on. And it's useful in what we're going to do to keep in mind that we can go back and forth like that. All right. So what we're going to do is, as I said, we want to start with such an X, and we want to construct a field theory. And we're going to roughly go from Bordisms to mapping spaces, and then from there to, well, whatever target C I want for my field theory. So I want to think of this mapping space step as kind of semi-classical. And in this step is where you get the quantum theory. So I'm not going to talk too much. I'll talk a little bit about this step. Again, I think Mike in his lectures might say more about that. There's a nice theory now about that step. But I want to emphasize in these lectures, you can calculate with classical topology these things, and that's a way to carry out computations in these finite homotopy theories. So let me illustrate. So supposing that M, now notice, by the way, I haven't specified a dimension for the theory. And in this first step, we don't need a dimension. It's only in this last step that we need to think about a dimension for a theory. So the theory we're going to, yeah. Okay, so given a manifold M, at the first stage, well, we want to define mapping space. I'll use this notation, which is just the space of maps from M into X. So that's another topological space, as the compact open topology say. So that's a very big space. But when we deal with it in a minute, we're going to use this idea of turning the space into a groupoid, as I said. Okay, so that would be if we had a closed space, that's what we would make that correspond to. And now what if we have a boardism? So let's say that M, rather, is a map from N naught to N1. So that's a picture as we drew like this. So here's M, here's N naught, N1. So what does this correspond to? Well, you see, we have maps from X, from M rather, into X, from this whole thing into X. So think of X as being BG. We would be talking about G bundles on M. But now, since this is a boardism, we can restrict to the incoming boundary and not. And we can restrict to the outgoing boundary and one. So what we obtain from a boardism is a correspondence like this. So this is a generalization of a function. If this were a function, you would picture that as being its graph. But this is a kind of generalized map from this function space to that function space. And what this quantization process is going to do is linearize this correspondence, turn this into something linear, and then this correspondence into a linear map. So I'll show you a little bit of that in a second. So that's the kind of mapping space we would assign there. Let me bring in domain walls as well. So imagine that I have, let's say, x1, x2 are these pi finite spaces. And now, what would a domain wall be? Well, a kind of semi-classical domain wall is going to be a space Y that sits, again, in a correspondence between X1 and X2. So why is that the right data for a domain wall? Well, if I have a manifold, take it now to be closed, and supposing I have the data for the domain wall. So here's this domain wall, okay? And in this part, we have, say, the theory X1. In this part, we have the theory I'm going to build with X2. So what kind of maps do I sum over? Well, I sum over maps, let's say phi1. So I need names. So let's call this M1 and M2, and let's call this piece N. So we're going to have a map from M1 to X1, M1 being the manifold including the boundary N. Phi 2 is a map from M2 into X2. And then psi, let's say, is a map from N into Y. And these have to be compatible, meaning that if I restrict phi 1 to n, then I get psi, and if I restrict phi 2 to n, I get psi. And if you think about it, that's the kind of mapping space you would want to, in a sense, sum over or quantize in order to quantize this domain wall. We could take boundary theories by having one or the other of these x's be trivial, just be a point, and then we would get boundary theories. Okay, and we could imagine composing domain walls, and composing domain walls will bring in this homotopy fiber product that I introduced yesterday. So we'll do more of that, but for the moment, I want to show you some slides here just to show you an example of how all this works. There we go. Okay. So here's an example where we take X to be BG, which means we're doing finite G gauge theory. And if I have a manifold M, we look at the maps of M into BG. As I said, that's the same as G bundles on M. So what are these G bundles on M? Well, this is a groupoid where the equivalence classes of objects are the isomorphism classes of principal G bundles, and the fundamental group at any point are the automorphisms of the G bundles. So for example, supposing we take M to be the circle, well, now we're looking at the mapping space of a circle into X. Without a base point, there's no base point in this picture, so this is the what's called the free loop space of X, symbolized like that. And again, if we pass from spaces to groupoids, this is the groupoid of G bundles on the circle. So you picture a G bundle on the circle, just to study it, introduce a base point, then we can look at the monodromy as I go around. That's an element of G. And if I move the base point, that element of G conjugates, and that's this G acting on G by conjugation. And so this groupoid is equivalent to G acting on G by conjugation. And here's a picture of G acting on G by conjugation. You have the elements X of the group G. For each element G, you have a map from X to the conjugate, GX, G inverse. If G centralizes X, that map goes back to X. Okay, so let's look at a mapping space with a domain wall. This domain wall is just a boundary. The boundary is just given, the space Y over there is just a point. And this is what we would call a regular or Dirichlet boundary theory in this context. And if we have that, then our bordisms, we can decorate the boundary and color some boundary components with this boundary theory. So here I have the interval colored on both sides with that boundary theory. So the mapping space, as I said there, maps from I into BG together with the lift of the map at these endpoints to the base point. Well, that's just a condition that these two points go to the base point. So in other words, this is the mapping space, where the boundary of the interval goes to the base point. So now we get loops in X, but based at the base point, those are the based loops of X. And the based loops of the classifying space, well, that's just up to homotopy, the group. It's a space with components labeled by the group. Each component is contractible. So in that case, our mapping space becomes the group. So I said that this last step is a kind of quantization, a linearization. And again, without telling you how we do it, let me just indicate how to do it in some special cases. So let's suppose that M is closed. And in the notes, I'll tell you what to do for a bordism like that with the correspondence. But here, let's just do it for M closed. And so we want to quantize in various codimensions. So again, I haven't told you the dimension of the theory. That will be some integer m, I'll call it. And what's relevant for the type of object you want to get is the codimension of this manifold in the theory, how far down it is from m. So at the top, we want a number. Here, we want a vector space. Here, we want a category. So what we do is we pass to the mapping space in each case. That was the first step. And now we have to turn the mapping space into something linear, into either a number, a vector space, a category. So how do we turn it into a number? Well, we count the space. Now, what are we counting? We're really counting the homotopy groups, or counting the associated groupoid. And because the space is pi finite, this count is finite. So this, in an ordinary quantum field theory, if you replaced this pi finite space by gauge fields for a positive dimensional group, something like that, this would be the stage at which you'd have the Feynman path integral. Instead, you just have a finite sum. We just sum over the components of the mapping space, so the homotopy classes of maps, and we count them not weighted by one, but we count them weighted by automorphisms, which is always the way that we count. So remember, the automorphisms are the self-maps. That's pi 1 based at that map. But because we might have higher automorphisms of automorphisms, we have to account for those as well. And so we get this alternating product like that. And again, the pi finite condition tells you that that's a finite product. Okay, in codimension 1, we want a vector space. And what's the vector space we want? We just want to take functions on this mapping space. But by functions, I mean locally constant functions. So again, something in homotopy theory where we have locally constant functions. Or functions on the groupoid, and that just amounts to functions on pi naught, just functions of the path components. In codimension 2, we want a vector bundle. And so again, I want to take the, we want a category. And the category I want is the category of vector spaces over this mapping space. But again, we should take vector bundles, I mean, over the mapping space, vector bundles which are locally constant in a sense, flat vector bundles. And that only sees the, that only sees the fundamental groupoid of X. So it just depends on the path components and pi 1. So again, let me make it concrete by illustrating. Let's again use the finite gauge theory, and let's do it in dimension 2, where that should be familiar. So what do we attach to a point? Well, the mapping space is just the maps into X. That's just X or BG itself. And BG as a groupoid, well, pi naught is trivial, and pi 1 is just a copy of the group. So as a groupoid, it looks like this. It has one object, and these blue lines mean self-maps. And I didn't put arrows because they're invertible, so the maps go both ways. Well, now we're supposed to take the category of vector bundles over this. Well, a vector bundle over this, there's only one point, so we just get a single vector space, but these automorphisms act. And so what we get is exactly a representation of G. And so what we get here is the representation category of G. That's the quantization. What do I get if I quantize the circle? Well, we already worked out the mapping space over here that we get the groupoid that it's equivalent to is G acting on itself by conjugation. And so now we get vector bundles over this picture. So we get a vector space at each group element together with an action like this. So that's a G equivariant vector bundle over G, where G is acting by conjugation. That would be if I was in dimension 3, sorry. We're in dimension 2, the circle's codimension 1, so we don't want a category, we want a vector space. And to get a vector space, we want to take the functions on the mapping space. So we just want to take functions on this groupoid. Well, that's a function, a number for each group element, but the numbers have to agree where there are these symmetries. So those are exactly the central functions on G, functions invariant under conjugation. And finally, we could look with this boundary theory, we could look at this interval. The mapping space is G, and so again, taking functions, now we get all functions on G. So this is a very pleasant way to compute in this finite gauge theory, and as I said, in any of these finite homotopy theories. All right. Let me give you one more example. So let's take this B squared A. So this is, again, an island question. Well, the sum is over pi naught. Homotopy classes of maps from M to X. And then I'm weighting the sum by these automorphisms and higher automorphisms. And each of these is a finite group, and then eventually these groups just are the trivial group. They have one element, so that product becomes a finite product.
Okay. There was a sort of overlapping question on Zoom. Taiwai, who asks, does X being pi finite mean there will be some factor in each term which a zero in either the numerator or denominator?
Those are ones. So a group always has an identity element, so the number of elements is one. for that group. Okay, thanks. So let's look at this example. So this example, as I say, has to do with the one-form symmetry of this finite abelian group A. And I'll take the dimension of the theory to be 5. So this would be acting on a four-dimensional theory. For example, it acts on a four-dimensional gauge theory where A is a subgroup of the center of the gauge group. And now let's look at it on a three-manifold. So a closed three-manifold. In the gauge theory, say that it would act on, we would get a state space. But now let's look in this topological theory at what we get. Well, we're two down from the top, so we expect to get a category. And that category, as we said, just depends on the fundamental groupoid. Pi naught of this mapping space, the homotopy classes of maps from M into here, is the second cohomology group, and pi 1 is the first cohomology group. So the groupoid we get has points which are labeled by elements of H2. I called them little m. And then there are self-maps at each point labeled by H1 with coefficients in A. So there's a group, an abelian group of these self-maps. So what we get is the category of vector bundles, which is to say we get a vector space at each point m. And then at that point, we get a representation of this abelian group. So we can decompose that representation of the abelian group according to the characters of the abelian group, the characters being the elements of the Pontryagin dual group. I've called those characters E. And so we get these multiplicity spaces. And so what it says is that a simple object in this category is supported at one particular M, and it's one-dimensional, where this is acting by the character E. So these simple objects are labeled by M and E. And what it tells you is that the state space, if we have this acting as a symmetry, then I haven't said enough to say this, but in the gauge theory, four-dimensional gauge theory, the state space, which is infinite dimensional, it's not a topological theory, the state space is one of these vector bundles. And so it can be divided into, as a direct sum, over these M's and E's. So that should be a familiar picture in four-dimensional gauge theory, in fact, where these are called kind of magnetic and electric flux. All right. Well, let me go back to the board and tell you about the last topic, which is defects. So just as a preliminary comment, supposing that we're in C, which is our symmetric monoidal category, and I have some object X in there, what we're going to encounter is something called HOM1X. So imagine, for example, that X is the category of vector spaces, and X, therefore, is a vector space. 1 is the tensor unit. That's the vector space C, the ground field. And what is HOM from C to a vector space? Well, it's given by the image of 1, which is to say it's a vector in the vector space. So HOM1X in that example is the collection of vectors in the vector space. But supposing that C is this Morita 2 category of algebras in vector spaces, so that's a 2 category where the objects are algebras. The morphisms between two algebras are bimodules, and the two morphisms between bimodules are linear maps that commute with the bimodule action. And so if we have X in here, which is an algebra, let's call it A, then HOM from 1 to A consists of left A modules. So in that case, they're not the elements of the algebra A, but they're left A modules. All right, so with that preliminary comment, let me tell you a little bit about defects. We don't have a lot of time, but I think enough to say something. So let's suppose that we have a manifold M, we can imagine it to be closed, and let's say have a submanifold Z. So Z is going to be the support of the defect. And now if we have a submanifold, we can choose a tubular neighborhood. So I'll call that nu for normal. So that's a tubular neighborhood. And I'm going to imagine that its closure is also nice. So its closure, nu bar over Z, is going to be some disk bundle. So let's suppose that Z has codimension. Equal to L, then the normal space at each point is an L-dimensional vector space, and this is a closed ball inside that vector space. The boundary is then a bundle of spheres. This is an SL minus 1 bundle. And now let's suppose that we have a field theory F, and I'll suppose that, well, let me call it sigma. I'll suppose that sigma is a topological field theory, and we want to talk about defects in the theory sigma. So if I relax the condition of being topological, as I showed you yesterday, we would have to shrink the links that I'm going to show you. Well, okay, so what's the link? If I'm at a point here, P, the link is the sphere in the normal bundle. So the link of P is the unit sphere in the normal bundle. That's the fiber of this over at the point P. So the definition is that a local defect at P is an object, say delta P, in HOM from 1 to my field theory evaluated on that sphere at the point P. So whatever my field theory assigns to that sphere of dimension L minus 1, we want to pick, well, I said informally an object, but you see that language is not right in that case. So the correct thing is to say we pick, well, I think I said it right, an object in HOM from 1 into that. And then a global defect is, well, something in HOM from 1 to sigma of the whole normal bundle. So the idea is that if we have this defect, we could imagine just cutting out this open tubular neighborhood. We're left with a new boundary component for M, or possibly several components. We view them all as incoming, and then we want to insert a state. We want to choose a vector there. That's what our defect does. Well, this would be choosing that vector globally. And this is saying we can compute the vector by integrating over Z, something higher categorical and local. So that's the basic idea. I'm going to take a few more minutes so that we finish up. Yeah, so let me just say that in the picture that I put up at the beginning, my colors, where we have sigma and we have this boundary theory rho. So remember that the non-topological piece is over here, but we're interested in part in topological defects. Those are defects that are either supported on here, which I'll call rho defects, or they're supported in here, that's kind of sigma defect, or they're supported, you know, in both, a sigma rho defect. But all of those are topological. And let me end this lecture by showing you some examples. But before I show you some examples, if I can have the iPad, I want to say one general thing about defects, which is that defects can be composed. So that composition is as follows. Here's an illustration in the case when we have two-point defects coming together. You can think of them in dimension two, as is written, or in higher dimensions. And so here are the two points. These two yellow points are coming together like that. But you see, the defects are labeled, if you like, by the links. And so what we have to do is follow the links in that process. So the links are these two circles. They're coming together, and at some point they merge and come one circle. Well, if we follow that process, that's this boredism. I've drawn these sections of the boredism of two circles merging into one. And so the composition law is gotten by evaluating the boredism. These are incoming circles, that's an outgoing circle, and that's what we had before when I pointed out that spheres in a field theory have a composition law. So that composition law here becomes the composition law on defects. Well, now imagine we had these points living in this row boundary. Now the link, I think you can see it, the link is now a half circle. We did this yesterday as well. And as these come together, you see those two half circles merge. And so these are these two half circles merging into a single half circle. And so we don't get, this is called the pair of pants. This is a kind of half of the pair of pants. That's called a pair of chaps. All right. So let me illustrate by showing you some defects. I think this is the last slide I have. Yeah, so we have some defects in this particular example. So I'm thinking of m equals 3. I've taken m here to be the dimension of the topological theory. And in the application to symmetry, this will act on a two-dimensional field theory. And again, we'll retreat to this finite gauge theory just for illustration. So this is an ordinary G symmetry acting on a two-dimensional field theory. We have this field theory together with its regular boundary that's given by a base point in BG. So let's study these line defects. So these are line defects in this topological three-dimensional theory with this boundary. So we could look at a line which is contained in that regular boundary, or Dirichlet boundary. That's what I call the row defect. And, well, the rule is we have to look at the link. The link, since the bulk is three-dimensional, that link, the unit sphere in the normal bundle, except it's not a sphere because we only have half the space. So in fact, you see, this is a link in a stratified manifold because we have this row is a submanifold, a boundary, and then we have a manifold in the boundary. So it's a stratified situation, and we have to think about the link in that context. So the link in that context is this interval as we had before. So again, we want to quantize because we want an element of Hom from 1 into whatever sigma assigns to it. So we have to compute what sigma assigns to it. And, well, the mapping space, as we said earlier, is the based loop space of BG, that's G. And now we're in codimension 2, because this is a one-dimensional manifold inside this three-dimensional theory. And the fact that we've put these boundaries, these boundary theories, essentially closes off the boundary. That's what boundary theories do. So this is like a closed one-manifold in the boredism category. It's a map from empty to empty, and so it gets assigned a category. And the category are the vector bundles over this mapping space. This is just a discrete set of points up to homotopy, and so we just get vector bundles on G. But now we can look at the fusion product, the fusion product given by this pair of chaps, and quite generally, you can check that, well, what we get in this case, you see, will be the product that gives us this categorified group algebra, that fusion category that we talked about last time. So that's something you would compute from this diagram. We would map this diagram into BG, in other words, look at G bundles, and look at the correspondence which restricts to the two boundaries. That's mapped to G cross G on this side and G here. And you'll see that what you get is exactly the map from G cross G to G, which is multiplication. And so this computes in the field theory to the push forward under multiplication, in other words, the convolution product. Okay, what if we have a defect, line defect in the middle there, sigma? Well, now the link is the circle. We did this before. We get the free loop space. And now we get this much richer picture of equivariant vector bundles over G, equivariant for the G action. And the fusion product now is the pair of pants. And, well, that's a kind of convolution on these equivariant vector bundles. So I want to point out that in this category, here, on the boundary, the simple objects are labeled by the group elements. So those are codimension one defects labeled by the group elements. Those are the usual ones you might think of when you think of that G symmetry. Here, we again have codimension one defects, but now we're in the middle. And remember, those are the central elements. They commute with everything on that boundary because they can be moved freely, not intersect the boundary. And in fact, this is what's called the Drinfeld center of this fusion category. It's a center in that sense. But here, the center, as opposed to the quantum mechanics example yesterday, that center is bigger, in a sense. It gets bigger rather than smaller. And so there are interesting objects here. There are objects that are supported just at the identity, but now become representations of the group, of the centralizer of the identity. Those are called Wilson lines in the theory. There are objects where all the centralizers act trivially, and they're just supported, say, on a single conjugacy class. Those are called the adhuft lines. And then there's a mixture, it's a category. And the simple objects are the vector bundles supported on a 1-1 conjugacy class, but allowing an irreducible representation. And those simple objects, if the group is non-abelian, they need not be invertible. So even if you start with this G symmetry and these defects on the row boundary, which are the ones you might think of, you automatically have in your theory, you have a much richer set of defects. Just as, say, if I start with a Lie algebra and I take its universal enveloping algebra, I get lots of interesting operators on every G module. So here we get these interesting operators, these kinds of lines, which need not be invertible. All right, so in the next few lectures, I'll tell you about two general classes of defects. They were highlighted last week in Justin's lecture. One are called quotient defects, and so I'll go back and talk about quotients a little bit. And then another one about defects that occur when we have certain dualities. And somewhere in there, I'll work in adhuft anomalies. Okay, thanks.